Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Eleanor Powell. She's a professor of political science at Yale University and an expert on the role of money in politics, and in particular, Congress. Ellie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Let me start with a few questions just to set the general landscape. We'll get into some more details later. But could you start by giving me a brief historical overview of the amounts of money being raised and spent on congressional elections in recent decades?
Well, this is something that's really changed a lot over time. I mean, in recent years, we've seen numbers in the billions. We've been talking about, you know, $4, $5, $6 billion in recent election cycles. But going back even 10 years, the numbers were half that. And going back even further, they dropped substantially. So we've seen a really sharp increase over the years that we have data on. We only have – the FEC only started tracking these numbers around 1980. So it's tough to say exactly how much was happening before that. But we've seen big escalation since 1980.
And are there important differences in that trend of growth for the money that is raised and spent by the candidate and the campaign, kind of the inside money, I guess is one way to think about it, versus the outside third party or independent spending that's going on?
Yes, we have seen a big increase in the independent spending, particularly in recent years. That's something that just didn't really happen very much early on in the period that we can talk about. And so the numbers that I gave you are focusing more on the sort of direct spending and fundraising by congressional candidates. But when you start to add in these other groups, the numbers get even higher.
Oh, even beyond those, that $4, $5, $6 billion you were mm-hmm. talking about before. Okay. And a lot there's a lot of worry that's been written about and expressed about this independent expenditure, outside money coming in. Is that more corporate?
Yes, corporations have always spent more, and this sort of really unlimited corporate spending is something pretty new. This is sort of this new wave of super PACs where corporations can contribute directly to these so-called super PACs, whereas corporations can't contribute directly to either congressional candidates or to PACs that can contribute to candidates. They can sort of create PACs that – and then organize them, run the overhead costs, do the management of those things. But it's a slightly – the actual contribution funds have to be walled off. And so this change to super PACs is a big transformation. And you've seen because of that a big increase in what corporations are sort of directly spending on congressional elections. And that super PAC money is all the sort of outside spending money. They can't give the super PAC money to candidates directly, but they can spend ads that sort of help candidates and support them on their behalf.
And a lot of people will look at this system and they say, well, basically votes and decisions are being bought and sold. Is it that simple?
No, it's not that simple. We do have, some very extensive anti-bribery and sort of other anti-influence laws that try to deter all of that. And members of Congress are actually prosecuted very rarely for that sort of outright corruption behavior. Now, in part, that's because it's very, very difficult to measure and prove. But I think most of the time, that sort of really extreme outright quid pro quo exchange of contributions is relatively rare. That's not to say it doesn't have many more subtle types of influence, but that level I think is – we see relatively rarely in American politics.
What about this? Is it fair to say, however, that the access to the member of Congress and the – in a sense, you know, the time that one gets to spend talking, that can be bought and sold?
Yes, that can be bought and sold, and members are really allowed to sort of outright sell their time to sort of say, in order to schedule the meeting, and you have to contribute X amount of money to schedule the meeting. And that money then gives you an opportunity to persuade the member. And so you may not be successful, but you have the opportunity to plead your case, which is a really powerful opportunity. And, you know, you get FaceTime. You get the opportunity to forge that personal bond. And so the next time the member hears your case, maybe they're just slightly more likely to think favorably of it. And it's not necessarily something that could even be thought of as bribery or that really outright stuff. But it doesn't mean it doesn't have consequences for what happens within the Congress.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with congressional expert Eleanor Powell, a professor at Yale University. I've had elected officials sitting where you're sitting right now. If one of them were to say to me, the money that I raise and the contributions that are made to me or spent against me have absolutely no bearing on what I do as a political representative. It's only relevant to the election cycle. Can we reliably say that that person is lying to me?
Well, lying's a strong term, but it's a pretty tough case to say that they aren't somehow being influenced by the sort of one-sided story that they're hearing. And so that's a really tough bar to think. Now, maybe they don't think that they're being influenced. Maybe they genuinely believe it. I can believe some members think that way. But the sort of net impact of no influence seems like a pretty tough case to believe.
Now, we were talking about the access, the FaceTime before. How does money then affect what members of Congress do? Break it out for me. What are the different ways it affects?
Well, it affects things in a bunch of different ways. So a lot of my research and my book project looks at how money shapes the internal dynamics of Congress. So the idea is members who are good fundraisers, who are good at raising all of this money, can then translate that to influence within the chamber. They can contribute to other members of Congress, and they can parlay this influence into getting into positions of leadership, and actually even passing their legislative priorities. So the idea is, and it's not at this outright vote buying across members, but the idea is, you know, I helped you raise a lot of money, and then you just sort of owe me a favor. You might be sort of slightly more likely to help me out when I come to you saying, here is my bill, here's my pet project, I'm really working hard, here are all the reasons I want to pass it, and you're just going to give me a slightly more favorable hearing, and you're just slightly more likely to vote in line for the things that I say. So again, it's not necessarily this like outright vote buying most of the time, but all of these sort of more subtle influences that exert biases into the policymaking process.
You know, there's one way that elected officials have said to me off the record that the money matters. I wanted to get your reaction to this. It's not the money that goes from one member of Congress to another. It's the interest group money that comes in. Is that it doesn't necessarily change the way they vote on a particular issue, but it does have an influence on the decisions that they make about what they're going to push and how much effort they're going to put into something. Whereas where they might just sort of let something else go and stay more silent. I have had elected officials, in a sense, confess that. What's your sense of that?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, members of Congress have so many demands on their time. They just are so overscheduled. There's so many policy priorities that they could push that they have to prioritize where they're going to spend their time. And so, you know, what exactly, you know, is going to be their top issue of the day, what they're going to be working most towards is a really easy thing to vary. And so I think, again, influencing both what gets brought on the agenda, what they spend their time, and even just little slight variants or tweaks on what actually goes into these, you know, many, many hundred pages long laws. You can, you know, slight tweaks on page 4 that might influence some contributor a lot. You know, that's the sort of influence that one might imagine.
I want to come back to a different version of this question later, but as far as the kinds of things you're talking about now, what do you say to someone that says, okay, you've got all this kind of cross-influence going on inside the chamber that's related to money. You've got this kind of subtle influence that comes from outside from different money sources. But there's a lot of different money out there, and votes aren't being really bought and sold. So really, in the end, it all kind of washes out. From a Democratic perspective, small d Democratic perspective, really not something we have to really worry about here.
Well, I think it has a couple of different effects. One effect that it has a polarizing effect of actually who can pass their legislative priorities. And so not all members are equally well positioned to fundraise for each other. And so some members are better able to fundraise, and they can be better able to fundraise and play this internal politics game for a variety of reasons. They can have better connections to wealthier individuals or wealthier donors who could help them out. But also, you can imagine members who are from safe districts can afford to spend any money they raise on this internal politics, whereas members who are from really competitive districts, they have to spend all the money they raise on just staying in office. And so they can't get involved in the sort of intra-member fundraising game, and it's tougher then for them to get into positions of leadership and to pass their legislative priorities just because they don't have as many favors to dole out. And so there are sort of more subtle polarizing effects, but also effects on, you know, just this relative ability to fundraise does have these secondary effects as well.
So from a citizen standpoint, that's interesting. Then I, if I, in a sense, on the one hand, have the bad fortune to live in a district where the elections are never competitive, but on the other hand, have the good fortune to live there, I might have, in a sense, my interests better represented because my representative can do these kinds of things more easily versus the person that's always scrambling to save their skin.
Exactly. Exactly. It has this sort of interesting status, interesting balance where the members who in some sense benefit the most by getting to stay in office are the members that lose the most in terms of their influence within the chamber and ability to get stuff done in Congress.
My guest is Eleanor Powell. She's a professor at Yale University, and she studies the role of money in Congress. So you've done some research that gets at figuring out what's motivating the business organizations who donate and spend in campaigns. So what? Tell me about that. What is it? Are they investing, or do they think they're investing in a particular type of outcome? Are they just trying to promote people that happen to share the same views? What's going on there with them?
Well, again, you see a variety. Not every donor is motivated by the same thing, but one of the things that I've found in my research is actually it looks like a lot of corporate donors are very short-term access-oriented. And what that means is essentially what they're looking for is they're looking to contribute to people who have influence over the policies that that industry or that corporation cares about. And as soon as the member loses influence over that area, the corporation stops giving to them immediately. And it's pretty stark. So you can imagine if you look at members who are on the big tax writing committee, Ways and Means, which just has huge financial ramifications across the economy. If a member loses his or her seat on Ways and Means, on this tax writing committee, they immediately lose about $300,000 in contributions from these corporate PACs. And that's real money to these members. And so it looks like not every donor is motivated by this, but at least some donors are motivated by these short-term access-seeking explanations. And not only that, it appears that they stop giving to the donor when they lose their influence over this policy area, and they start giving to the political opponent who gets their seat from the other party.
I was going to ask you about that. So there's no loyalty that way.
It doesn't even look like there's ideological loyalty that way or sort of partisan loyalty. There are some donors that are, you know, partisan and ideological, and it's not to say that there aren't corporations that behave that way, but there are certainly other sizable numbers of corporations that are more behaving as just pure short-term access-seeking influence and not looking over the longer time horizons and not looking to sort of play a sort of more ideological strategy.
That's interesting because that's a critique that's often made of corporations about the way that they think about their own businesses. You know, you only think till the next quarterly report. You're not looking long-term. I suppose they're being consistent here in that sense.
That's it. I was actually a little surprised that they were quite that short-term oriented. It seems a little short-sighted, but
what about individual donors? What's motivating an individual that dips into their pocket and sends someone a check?
Well, it depends a little bit on whether we're talking about small donors or large donors, donors who are donating, you know, small amounts, and particularly folks who are donating over the internet. You know, there's no personal relationship between the member and the donor. I don't think they're trying to get anything selfish out of that contribution, but they're just, whether they're ideological or partisan, probably something in that realm. If you're talking sort of larger scale, big donors, these big super PAC donors who are giving sort of millions and millions of dollars, there's clearly a personal relationship there with the donor that the member is trying to cultivate with the member. And it's a little more difficult to tease out what the motivations are. It's probably somewhat ideological. It could be access. It's difficult to really flesh that out.
Well, let's move and talk about solutions now. And I want to go pie in the sky to start. We'll bring it back down to earth after this. But let's assume that you don't have the limitations of Supreme Court decisions to keep you from doing what you might want to do. And let's also suppose that money were no object. What system would you, knowing what you know, put in place to replace what we've got?
Again, living in the sort of ideal, abstract, never going to happen world, I think the system I would probably lean towards is one of a pure public financing system. It's the only way to fully eliminate all these types of influence. The problem is, in practice, we're very, very far removed from that ever happening.
Any system around the world that you would look at and say, well, that one is pretty close to what I'd like to see?
Nothing comes to mind. You do see American politics is relatively unique in the sort of scope and scale of legalized contribution patterns. But if you look at other countries, particularly other European countries, their contributions are increasing too. And so it's not clear that they're not going to end up where we are as well.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with congressional expert Professor Eleanor Powell. All right, so we talked pie in the sky. Let's bring it back to reality now. Putting in all the political and financial realities, looking at the past decisions of the Supreme Court in terms of what can and cannot be done, what changes realistically would you like to make?
And here we're really hamstrung by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has really strongly indicated that they think of money as speech and they're really opposed to any sort of limitations. And if anything, the direction of movement on the Supreme Court in recent years has been to loosen restrictions basically every cycle. And so if I were to extrapolate forward over this cycle and the next couple of cycles, I'm going to expect further loosening of campaign finance restrictions, barring some substantial change in the composition of the court, which then means if you can't limit the contribution levels, if they're going to remove these aggregate limits as well, then we're really left with some small-scale changes. Essentially, we can do things that improve the type of disclosure that we have, improve the measurement. So the things might – influence might be happening, but at least we can try to discuss and talk about and measure and observe, and newspapers can cover what's happening. So I would move towards – assuming we can't do anything about the actual money, and that's going to play out the way it is – Congress could do things to improve disclosure and transparency. So, for example, the Senate still doesn't use electronic filing for their fundraising reports. Mm. It's this amazing system where the Senate campaigns, you know, they have it all on Excel spreadsheets, but they don't just send the Excel spreadsheet to the FEC. No, no, no. Of course, they, you know, will print it out, and then those printouts get sent over to a Senate office, and then it gets sent to the FEC, and then they have to digitize it, and all of this takes weeks and weeks, and by then the election is over, and the influence. But, you know, you can't even talk about what contributions happened or mattered. So one trivial thing that the Senate could pass, there are bills currently under consideration any day, are just electronic disclosure. The House has been doing this for years. This is incredibly bureaucratically wasteful that the Senate is doing. It's just for pure obfuscation and delay. And again, they could change it tomorrow. It wouldn't be a big deal. Another thing that they could do that would be, again, simple and trivial is to just actually fund the FEC and staff it at the Federal Election Commission, the commission that does this monitoring. They could just, you know, they haven't actually increased the size of the FEC for several decades. And whilst the scope and scale of money has increased substantially, the burden on what they're expected to do has increased substantially. So just giving the ability, the organization, a better ability to do its job and monitoring. Again, these are trivial things at the margin. They wouldn't necessarily change how much influence is happening, but they would at least be able to talk about what that influence might be a little better and more clearly than we can now.
And some states have experimented with some versions of public financing, Arizona, for example, Vermont, and the city of New York. And it involves kind of a voluntary piece that, you know, you provide a certain amount of money, and if you're not going to opt for it, then you make sure that your opponent, if your opponent's opting for it, has enough to kind of counter the outside contributions. Do you think those have any kind of potential at the national level?
Well, we've seen some of those similar federal matching programs for at least presidential races, but the problem
which
is
no one's ever going to use anymore, apparently.
Yes, exactly. Right. The problem is the scale is so low, and the amount that candidates can raise outside the system is so big that they're just defunct effectively now. They're just not really even under consideration. So you could do something similar with Congress, but again, because the scale seems to ramp up every election cycle, it's tough to set up a program that wouldn't become outdated pretty quickly.
Now, you mentioned the limitation of the Supreme Court, your expectation that it's going to strike down even more restrictions. Aside from the Supreme Court, why is it so hard in this country to limit the flow of money into politics? What is it about our political system or our culture that makes this difficult?
Well, I mean, in part, it just goes back to, you know, the free speech ideas in the Constitution, the sort of deeply held views that people should be able to advocate their ideas and, you know, express those beliefs and help persuade others to what they share. And so it's a pretty deeply held American value that's at the same time, in real conflict, when we actually start to think about how to implement it and how to restrict money and sort of types of undue influence that also distort democracy in various ways. So there's a real conflict about how to implement these two American ideals, and there's no easy, simple fix to solve them.
One of the things I was wondering about in that regard, get your reaction to this, is you see it here in the state of New York, I think, when the conversation about public financing comes up, is this very deep and particularly true today, anti-government feeling. And so when someone says, well, Albany has a problem, and one way we're going to try to make it better is to publicly fund campaigns, the immediate reaction is, wait a minute, you're going to spend my tax dollars on those guys? And so you get that kind of knee-jerk negative reaction.
Yeah, and I think people think that the government shouldn't be spending money on campaigns, especially if they can get the money elsewhere. Why should we sort of raise taxes in order to fund these programs? Which is how you'd obviously have to do it if you went to a public financing program, and if you were to finance that program at the levels that we see now for presidential and other campaigns, it would be a pretty sizable amount of money. So there are just trade-offs for how much you're willing to pay in terms of taxes to sort of net out any of these sorts of influences.
Another counter-argument to trying to change it that you hear sometimes goes something like this. The money that comes in reflects some kind of intense interest that someone or some organization has in the process. And so fundraising can act as kind of a pre-election election that helps us to sort out the legitimate from the illegitimate candidate. So if a candidate's not able to raise money from his or her fellow citizens and organizations, there's a problem with that candidate anyway. So there's kind of a democratic function to this, and we shouldn't really be worrying about it too much. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, the so-called invisible primary, call it, right? The idea that journalists and others, elected officials, contributors are really pre-screening things for the American public. I think that the sort of the normative question surrounding that is whether you want or trust those folks to do your pre-screening, whether they have the same interests and values that the sort of general public does. And you can imagine all sorts of reasons why that might not be a representative group and why the sort of general public might prefer slightly different candidates or mixes of candidates than those sort of elite types would.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Chapter of life I'm currently living? I guess I would say research. I've got a bunch of excited projects that I'm really enjoying right now, and I'm looking forward to continuing it.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait? I guess I can be a little bit of a perfectionist in my research. I sort of want to keep polishing and never fully finish it and send it off. And it's always a problem for an academic.
Finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Again, it's a tough question, but I think it's been just the sort of holistic process of writing a book from start to finish, all of the different steps and stages and moving things along the way. There are a surprising number of hurdles there that slow things down, but I guess that's the nature of the publication process.
The book hasn't come out yet, but does it have a title?
Where Money Matters in Congress.
Great. We'll look for it. That was Eleanor Powell. Ellie, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest. You can also follow us on Twitter at Campbell Convos.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Research assistance was provided by Brooke Weinstein. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. Visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations for more information.